Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. My name is Bob Nancer.
I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guests today are two poker players who go by the handles of Just Joe and Mr. B. Gentlemen, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you.
Hello.
All right, Just Joe, you first. You're about 40 years old. How long have you been playing poker, and when did you get started?
Well, I think my first gambling memory was way back when. I'll give you a life rundown here. I was 9 years old growing up in a kind of small dead-end town in upstate New York, and every Tuesday night, my father would have a local poker game with him and his buddies. We're talking nickel, dime, quarter type stakes, $5 buy-in. Times were tough in this town, so that was kind of where it was because those were the highest stakes available. So I would watch my dad and his friends play again, 9 years old, and I would just the one thing I kind of took away from it is that normal people are really bad at gambling by default, and I would watch hands where my dad, they would be playing seven card stud. My dad would have a king up and he would be betting into three players, and I would kind of look over at the hole cards of the player, one of his friends, and I would see that he had like a queen 4-3 with two hearts or something like that, and it would go bet, call, and he would call, which is, and for
even
anyone
nine,
that
for
anyone that plays stud, even a 9 year old assistant paper boy, which is what I was at the time.
An assistant paper boy.
Yeah, I
was that after the promotion?
I wasn't old enough to actually have a paper route, so I was an assistant to an 11 year old who had the paper route. But so 1 week, one of the friends, didn't have the buy-in of $5, so he was absent. And nobody in the town is going to, nobody in the game is going to loan him the $5 because, like I said, times were tough. So my dad said, oh, well, my kid can play. So, they played mostly dealer's choice, seven card stud variants. And I think I won, I deposited with my paperboy money, and I think I won like $13 or something that week, which is essentially almost all the money on the table. And, after that week, they were calling me the ringer and so forth. And, even one guy said that, this guy is not allowed to play ever again. And, so I guess that's
your first play and your first back off.
Yeah. It was, and I didn't even get a comped meal.
Did your dad have the juice to get you back in the game?
I don't know if he wanted it because he was one of the victims.
Okay. Moving to more adult worlds. You played a lot of online poker before Black Friday. Black Friday kind of shut down American sites. Mm-hmm. What'd you do?
Well, so we're out of college. I went to college and got an IT degree and got a corporate job and was suit, tie, all that, the cubicle.
Sorry.
Yeah, exactly. I did that for about a year and a half, and I knew that it wasn't for me. Getting up at 7:30 and ironing your shirt for the day and so forth. So it was around 1999, and I was playing around on the internet one night, and I came across this site called Planet Poker. And I thought, well, this is interesting, and it said real money online poker over the internet. I thought, well, that's great. So I downloaded the software, and I created an account, I logged in, and this is 1999, there were 11 people logged in.
I remember Planet Poker.
Yeah. There was one game going. It was $1, $2 limit hold'em, and I deposited $50 from my paycheck, and I lost it. Rinse and repeat over the next, couple months, and I finally got a deposit that stuck. And by then, some other sites were popping up. Party Poker and Paradise Poker, I think the next one.
Well, Planet Poker, isn't that the one where the RNG was published or something? They wanted to show how truly good their software was, so they published their RNG and people just figured it out.
Yeah, that seems like a mistake, and maybe I guess in hindsight I could maybe blame my early losses on that. But But no, I mean, eventually, you know, the moneymaker effect happened and poker was on TV and, you know, poker just exploded. And, you know, I quickly went from, you know, $1, $2 games to 10, 20 to 15, 30 to 30, 60, so and so. And, you know, it was maybe 6 months or so before I quit my job. I had like a $50,000 bankroll and I was just, you know, I was still single, although I was engaged. My wife-to-be said, you know, hey, if this is what you love, go for it. And I did. And
sounds like a keeper.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. My wife is, you know, she's not involved in gambling. She doesn't really understand a lot of what I do, especially these days, but she's very, very supportive. So I think that's pretty ideal.
Yeah, it's hard to find. I was the same way. You know, I found one who understood it and supported it. And yeah, it was one of the best decisions I ever made. But so you were talking about the moneymaker effect and how poker exploded, but you didn't shift over to No Limit. You stayed kind of a limit specialist?
Yeah, I guess. You know, my specialty, I found after the first year that heads up limit hold'em was kind of the place for me to be. Because there were issues with, you know, people cheating and people colluding. And, you know, when you would play live poker in Vegas, all the old veterans of live poker would say, like, oh, I don't trust that online. And there's so much cheating. You could have two guys on the phone. And, you know, while that was true, you know, that was essentially built into the cost of doing business as an online player. That being said, it didn't take long for other good players to kind of be online and be in the full ring games, the 6-max and the 9-max games. So I kind of found my way into the heads up world where, you know, you would just sit at 30 tables, 50 tables, 100 tables all over the internet and then just wait for the person to sit with you. You know, and if it was a pro, you'd try them out, you know, and then ultimately, you know, probably quit or they would quit or whatever. But if it was a fish, you know, you would just play until their account was drained. And, you know, I found that was definitely, I was at this time married and children were starting to show up and I felt like that was the easiest way to, make a living gambling professionally, without really all the swings. I mean, we both had friends that were, you know, in and out of money all the time. And I just couldn't even imagine putting my wife and my family through that if my objective was to play the toughest games out there.
So you weren't trying to play the toughest games.
I would try out everyone, you know, just because some players who were winning players were very good full table players, full ring players, but they were terrible heads up players. So, yeah. And some of those guys had, you know, big bankrolls online. So, you know, you would never want to pass on the opportunity to play somebody where you actually had an edge that was, you know, deep pocketed like that. But for the most part, I mean, especially, you know, throughout 2005 to 2010, pre-Black Friday, you know, there was just a lot of easy money in online poker, and I just tried to catch as much as I could of it.
So in May, we had, or June, we had Rob Wrightson on, who talked about solving heads-up limit hold'em back. Sure. Long, late 90s, I guess, and they made an enormous amount of money training girls to play. And you mentioned before we came on the air that you ran into some of these girls.
Yeah, I was actually interested in the girl part. Like, what was it about girls, training girls, that was superior to training guys for online poker? It's, you know, obviously in a live poker setting, you know, if you can have a beautiful girl and you can train her to be a poker killer, then, you know, a beautiful girl can make more money, I think, than a guy can.
I think that may have been part of the idea. Rob lives in Southern California, where there are, you know, the bike and the Commerce Club, and there's huge action there in those poker clubs. And I think their idea was that they would also go in and be able to play live, but I think there was so much money to be made online at the time that...
Yeah. And I agree, and I did listen to that interview, and I had heard him mention an account, Poker Girl Z, who was a pretty infamous heads up player online, and I don't remember really battling too much with her, but I knew that she was good, and you know she was on every site, and I knew that she was a winning player. I heard him mention last week or whenever he was on that you know, they had ultimately accused her of being a bot. And I will say that that kind of happened to every heads up player, heads up specialist that would play only heads up online. But and even within the Limit Hold'em community, there was some speculation that she was a bot because nobody knew her. The mid to high limit hold'em community is very small. And, you know, seeing she was from LA, you know, a lot of us play at Commerce. Nobody knew her from Commerce. Nobody knew her from literally anywhere. So we all assumed she was a bot. That being said, when the, you know, when she released the video of her playing poker, then, you know, I think all of us knew that she wasn't, in fact, a bot. But it was interesting hearing the story because that's the first time I've ever heard a story that, you know, that a solver actually trained one of these people to play heads up limit hold'em.
Yeah, and so now when you and they stole her money, some of the sites stole her money, which she never got back. But so when you got accused of being a bot, what happened? How did you get out of that or prove to them you weren't? Or
The funny thing is, really, all you had to do is send them like proof that you were actually a live poker player as well. Like you would send them proof of you playing at the World Series. You know, oh, here's my Hendon Mob profile and it's a picture of me and where I'm from, and here are my results, you know, playing here. I cashed in the main event, you know, in the early 2000s.
Well,
something.
Sure. But you know, yeah, if you didn't, I mean, there were a lot of people who didn't play live poker because sure. The internet was so good. I mean,
right. And where I, you know, we're both from the Midwest, and, you know, getting to LA or getting to LA or Vegas to play live is it's a flight, you know? So yeah, it was really my only option.
So we actually have two guests on the show today. So Mr. B, is it true your name came about because you are indeed a bot?
Actually, I'm not a bot. My name came from the origin of Joe and I's relationship as far as like casino gambling. I was also a poker player, and he brought me in to show me a few things. And he's like, yeah, let's try this out. I'm like, okay, no problem. So we got into the casino, you know, we kind of looked the same. We have similar haircuts. We're a similar age. And we would have a lot of inside jokes because we've known each other for about 15 years. And we would sit down at the table and look kind of similar, and we'd be playing blackjack or something. And the dealer would say, hey, how long you guys known each other? I'd be like, who, that guy?
brothers, right?
Exactly, right. So we had to kind of differentiate our personalities a bit, and that's where our handles came from. Joe, for example, you know, will kind of come into a local casino, and he'll have a camouflage hat and maybe, you know, a mustache, and, you know, he'll bet like $5 a hand and, you know, have like handful of beverages. And Mr. B is a little bit more outgoing and outspoken, and he tends to just kind of talk to everybody and not really pay attention to the game he's playing and be a little bit more extravagant.
Okay, well, good. So he denies that he's a bot.
They both do.
Just Joe, 2012, a poker game by IGT called Heads Up Poker. Have you heard of it?
I have. So, you know, as most people know, Black Friday, April 15th, 2011, was kind of the end of the world as we know it for online poker players. So, you know, in one day, I went from having a high-paying job to being unemployed. So, you know, while we kind of waited for online poker to come back, you know, there was some speculation that
still
it would be
waiting.
Very, yeah, exactly. You know, there was some speculation that it was like the end of the year, and I thought, well, okay, I can, you know, I can do that at the end of the year. You know, I'll travel. I'll go to LA or Vegas, you know, play live for 6 months. It'll be good to get out of the house. And about that time, you know, I was coming to Vegas to play, and IGT released this machine, and there was a lot of buzz about it in the Bellagio poker room, and it played heads up limit hold'em. Great. You know, I knew a lot. I was a heads up specialist. I knew a lot of other heads up specialists.
Is this the game with Phil Hellmuth's picture on it? And when it sold you, and there were others, poker pros as well?
I think that's the current version of it. Before that, there was no, I think you're talking about Johnny Chan and Phil Hellmuth.
That's not the same game.
It is the same. It's the same software, but that was version 2. So the original version was a non-branded bot. And, you know, and we knew a little bit about the bot just through the community. You know, there were things like, you know, we found out that in Nevada, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in Nevada, a skill-based machine could not adjust to the person it was playing. It had to treat every single hand as if it was independent, and it was the first hand you had ever played against it. So even if you had your player's card in and you were playing on this machine for an hour, it couldn't learn your exact strategy.
Correct.
It was against gaming laws in Nevada.
I believe what you're saying is correct.
Right.
And also I heard when they first had it, it was too strong, and they had to dumb it down a little bit because the average public would just get massacred
by it. So it was what's known as a GTO bot, which Game Theory Optimal, it plays a very solid strategy to beat the top professional and also the casual gambler, which is a little tough to accomplish because the styles are very different, right, between the two. You know, they had it all over Vegas, and I definitely noticed right away that some places had it turned down more than others. I think it was at the Aria, where I would play and get crushed every time by it. I mean, it was very, very tough. But then you would go out to the Suncoast or the Red Rock or something like that, and then I would win 90% of sessions, and it would just be an absolute joke. In fact, I remember one time at the Red Rock, I went to the cashier with a $9,400 ticket, slot ticket, which is pretty hard to do without hitting a taxable. So, you know, they would say, "Where did you get this?" I would say, "Over the poker machine." So they would send slot techs over and shine flashlights in the machine to make sure I didn't put the monkey paw up into the machine to make it release all the coins.
Did you not consider cashing out smaller tickets?
I did after that, yes. But yeah, there was some interesting, you got some interesting looks. But yeah, so what I came out, you know, which started as a live poker trip, ended up in basically 2 weeks of me playing this poker bot all over town. And at the end of the 2 weeks, I had every top card in town. I had 7 stars. I had the platinum at the Cosmo. I had the station's chairman card. I had the one at the Boyd Properties. I forget what it was, the Emerald, I think it was called. But I had every top card in the whole town, and when I went home about a week later, I started seeing some of the mailers that were coming in, and they were larger than anything I've ever seen before. I mean, they were $2,000 times four. Come back to the Suncoast and stay in our suite, and they were enormous, and it was that way for every single casino. It was
kind of twist my arm.
Yeah. So I would be playing at places, and I would have the host come up and I was playing 20-40 limit hold'em. This is not a large game, right? And I would have hosts come up and say, you know, "Oh, anything you want, you know, we'll do anything." And you're like, "You're the biggest gambler we've ever seen." And I was literally playing like a $1,000 buy-in game or something, playing 20-40 limit hold'em, which is... you know, most mid-stakes game.
To them, you're betting $20-$40 a spin on a slot machine in their mind.
Right. So, you know, it was kind of my first, the first time that I ever noticed that the inefficiencies that can sometimes exist in casinos, which kind of pushed my focus from poker into advantage play things.
Is that what actually flip the switch for you?
That was part of it. Although, you know, being in Vegas more and being in the poker rooms here, you meet, you know, you have peers that are very knowledgeable about things outside of the poker room. So, you know, you start with that, and then somebody else says, "Well, hey, I know this other play," and you know, "Come to the Rio and I'll show you this thing," and then you know, you see that, and then it just kind of, you know, the more you network, the more plays you kind of learn in the AP world, and for the most part, APs are more likely, I think, to show you the secret sauce over like a poker player who might have a secret game somewhere. You know,
well, yeah, there's a finite number of tables at that
correct.
Secret game. So,
right.
I mean, a finite number of seats.
Right. Now, your results at the limit hold'em, it clearly, to me, it sounds like they were setting the theoretical on this machine way too high. So the theoretical is actually negative given for a skillful player, and they were setting it at 3 or 4% and just couldn't give you enough.
We were told that, in fact, a host at a strip property, I won't name the name the property, but that the theoretical was 11% at one strip property, and they were treating every pot. So if you would play a $400 pot, where $200 of your money went in and $200 of the house's money went in, it would treat it as a $200 bet at 11% hold, and you're playing 200 hands an hour. So the theoreticals, you know, were enormous.
Wow. So even if you could just play break even on this machine, you'd be making a ton of money just off the mailer.
If you can, the mailers, and you have more comps and show tickets and stuff than you can do.
Well, and also a lot of the places give you free roll tournament entries. Like, correct, yeah. We'll have a $50,000 blackjack tournament, and it's free for you to join, and that kind of thing.
There was a one casino on the strip that had a promotion for Zappos gift cards. And I think that if you did so many points, you would get up to $2,500 in Zappos gift cards. And
it took you 2 days to max that, or something.
It took me about 3 hours to get the $2,500. And so then I recruited some friends and said, hey, come on over to this place, and we'll get you some new shoes. And ultimately, I ended up with like $15,000, I think, in Zappos gift cards. Once nice. I doled out the paychecks to the friends.
How long did that last?
6 months, I would say. We had a friend who was playing the MGM, I think, and he said something like, I don't understand. I played it. He was a poker player. I don't understand. I played this for 4 hours, and I got $10,000 in express comps.
Yeah, the funny thing with that is he goes, I should probably tell somebody. Like, he wanted to tell the slot tech because he thought the machine was broken.
Oh, Jesus.
And actually, with Joe's story here, that's kind of the moment when he was telling me he was staying in the suite and making $10,000 a day playing against a robot computer that I got much more interested in non-poker things as well. You know, that's kind of evolved our current business starting then, really.
So you had a Mississippi stud game at the Rio. Somebody introduced you to that. That seemed to be a threshold moment in your life.
So I had a friend at the poker table that said, hey, I have to go over to the Rio for like an hour. Why don't you come along? And I said, well, I don't really like the Rio, but okay, I'll ride along. We were in a poker game or whatever. And we go over there, and he doesn't really explain anything to me. And we get over there, and we set up this table, Mississippi Stud. I'd never played it before. And so we sit down, we buy in. He said, we're betting table max. I think it was $500 or something at the time. And he said something like, see that guy over there? I said, yeah. And he said, he's with us. And I'm like, okay, that's weird, but okay. And I got my hand dealt, and it was like 7-5 offsuit or something. And he leans over and he said, yeah, I would call one. And I called one, and the dealer flipped over a 7. And I said, oh, okay. And then, the light bulb went off in my head, and that was kind of the my introduction to that.
And somehow that changed your life.
Yeah, I mean.
Introduced to a game with a 50% edge, it kind of, changes your idea.
Poker is hard. People try in poker. The days of people just coming out in and firing off 20,000-30,000 for fun is long gone, but the opportunities in casinos seem to definitely outpace a lot of stuff you can do in poker these days. So, and it's fun, because our transition from kind of full-time poker to part-time poker, part-time AP is that we get to kind of do something new every day, and that's if you're a person that plays hold'em every day for 10 straight years. I don't care how much money you make, it gets boring.
Yeah.
But when you go back and forth, you tend to look like each other some more.
Yeah.
That tend to happen. All right. So we're going to take a brief commercial break. And when we come back, we're going to hear about how Mr. B got back roomed for the nerve at eating dinner on a comp.
The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In July, there's a $600,000 Mad Money promotion. All month long, there will be two casino-wide progressives going on. The major one must be hit between $10,000 and $25,000. And if anyone playing when it goes off doesn't get the maximum award, they will receive $25 in free play. The smaller progressive runs between $1,000 and $2,500. It is geared to hit approximately three times per day. On both progressive, you're eligible on any machine, any time, if you have your card inserted and have bet at least $1 in the minute prior to the jackpot being hit. At videopoker.com is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Powerhouse Poker. This is a 10 coins per line game where you get dealt extra hands, some with multipliers, when you're dealt a paying combination. For example, if you're dealt two pair, you may be given hands, and four of them have multipliers between 4x to 8x. How many extra hands you get and how big the multipliers are varies from game to game. The extra hands start from the same position and the same hold as you made. Let's say you're dealt two pair, queens and fives, in a game where it's correct to hold both pairs. Should you decide only to hold the queens, as many players incorrectly do, the extra hand will all start from holding a pair of queens. The game always returns more than the five-coin version of the same pay schedule, and no strategic variations are necessary in order to play the game accurately.
All right, we are back with Just Joe and Mr. B. Now, Mr. B, before the show, you were telling Richard and I about a time you got back-roomed for having the nerve to eat dinner. Tell us about that.
Okay, so I was in a casino in North America, and I was hungry. So I met an associate of mine, and I happened to play rather large at this casino. So they gave me a very large comp, over $1,000, and it expired at midnight. It just so happened to be 10:30 p.m. So I said, okay, associate, let's go have some food. You know, you can have whatever you want. And we went to a nice restaurant, and I'm not a big drinker, but I said, hey, you know, I'll get you a bottle, whatever you want, no problem. And we sat down, and he said, oh, can I have a bottle of this or that? They're like, no, we only have, you know, shots or drinks or whatever it is, you know. And we were at steaks, and I talked to the manager. I'm like, hey, can you find this for him? And she's like, sure, Mr. VIP, you know, no problem. We'll go ahead and we'll find that for you. So we ate our dinner. Our dinner bill was like $200 or $300. Still had way too much money to spend. And she came back with a bottle of wine. And I'm like, oh, great. Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, no problem. Gave him the comps, generous tip. And we left. Or so we thought. Anyway, we got to the exit and it was blocked off and it was near a nightclub. So there was a lot of security presence, you know, people trying to go to the nightclub. And I just got into town. I was going to bed. And I tried to get out.
Just you and your two bottles of wine.
My bottles of wine and my associate, right? And I got stopped immediately by security. He said, you just ran into that restaurant and stole that wine. I said, well, it's completely factually untrue. I mean, I was just leaving. I just ate dinner and I pointed back at my seat where I was just sitting. But everybody was cleaning up since they were closing. And he couldn't verify it right away. And he put his elbow on my chest. And I'm like, well, that's not very nice, you know. But I'll wait a moment, let him clarify it, and I'll go to bed. So next thing you know, there's nine security guards surrounding me. And they're like, no, you definitely stole that wine. I'm like, definitely did. And I gave them the name. A few minutes went by. They were all puffed up. And, you know, we were exchanging words, but I was pretty calm. And after a few minutes comes by, you know, he's still being not so nice. And he's like, oh, you're free to go. I'm like, well, yeah, because I didn't do anything. I mean, how will you compensate me? You know, I'm a VIP. You know, I just got harassed for eating dinner at your property. And he goes, compensate you? You know what? We're going to take you to the complaint department. And he signaled his security guards to grab me. And they took me into the back room, like by force. So I just want to point out, this is actually my first back rooming. You know, we always kind of talk about how we have clean IDs and how that's a big benefit in our business. And we try to really keep that. So in their eyes, they have no other reason to suspect me of anything. I haven't even been in this casino. I just had dinner. And so they basically put a VIP in the back room just for having a comp bottle of wine. And I'm sitting back there and I'm asking some basic questions like, why am I in the back room? And eventually the a very concerned looking security manager comes out and just tells me to get the hell out of there, because he knew that they broke the law and that they were not doing right by their customer at that point.
So we don't know where in North America this was, although it narrows it down to about 800 casinos. Have you talked to Mr. Nersessian or somebody similar about whether or not you might get another bottle of wine out of this if you pursue it?
He heard the story and thought it was very amusing that a casino would do that. In this particular part of America, he doesn't necessarily want to take that on. However, they may be hearing from me with a different representation.
Yeah, I think if you actually wanted compensation, you're not going to get it from a security guard. I would go to the host and raise holy hell and say, you know, look at what these guys did to me. What do you know?
And that's plan B. You know, I'm still evaluating my options. This was, you know, in the last year or so. And, you know, I haven't really had the time to, you know, make them pay yet. But
like some casinos have like non-negotiable chips that they'll give you. Right. So you have to bet them. But once you can't cash them out, but you can bet them, you know, that might be a good way to get compensated.
Right. And I'm just treading a little bit cautiously because it happens to be a place where I enjoy gambling at. You know, it's a fun place to play. And I'd like to return there in good
fun
terms.
Fun place meaning lucrative. So when you guys play together, which one is the big player and which one is the dummy?
So Mr. B is the big player, as we kind of mentioned before. He's the dressier one, and you know, he has the nice watch and drives the fast car, and you know, he's a little bit shady of a character. You know, he'll come in, he'll take your money and your woman. Where Just Joe is just, you know, he's your average schlub. You know, he fits in any kind of scenario. He bets red chips. He drinks Bud Light. Yelp complains about the president, complains about, you know, just about everything. Just Joe is just your average guy. Nobody ever thinks of him. In fact, I came up with the name Just Joe, you know, because we were playing somewhere and this guy said, well, what's your name, bud? And I said, Joe. And he's like, Joe what? And I said, Just Joe. Just Joe is fine. He said, okay, I'm going to put you in as Just Joe. I said, okay. So, I mean, yeah.
That's... Now you're going to have to change it to Just Sam or something.
Joe Sixpack.
So, yeah. Just Joe, have you had any back-offs, back-roomings, 86ings?
Only one, and it was actually at an Indian casino. So I, although, you know, we have all heard horror stories of an Indian casino, of, you know, the things that can go on just because of their sovereign immunity. But actually, it was a very professional back off. I mean, the force was definitely there. I mean, six security guards to my room at 2 a.m. saying, you know, we've identified you as an advantage player and you're leaving now. And
wow, at 2 a.m.
Yeah, it took me right out of my hotel room. So they walked me down for the walk of shame through the lobby, and people are laughing and smiling. And, you know, I wasn't handcuffed or anything, but, you know, they walked me out. And then as I stood in valet waiting for my car, they actually had security guards lined up on the doors just in case I was thinking of trying to run back in and play blackjack again.
But and what did they nail you for? Is it card counting?
Or? Yeah, I mean, more advantage play stuff, more advanced advantage play stuff. And I had been playing there for a while, and I had been playing with a partner, not Mr. B, who was kind of infamous in the advantage play world. I won't name his name.
Was an OG.
Yeah.
Guilt by association type
of
thing?
Yeah, he might have had a book written about him. Yeah, I mean,
I can't wait for the show to get over so he can tell us more about that.
But that was really the only thing. And, it rattled me a little bit because I think everyone's first back off, first 86ing, you know, because they make sure that they want to project the idea that they mean business. You know, but once you drive off and you get down the street a little bit and your heart stops racing, you know, everything just kind of goes back to normal. And then, you know, I was very lucky that nothing ever came from it, you know, even further. I didn't lose any kind of status at any kind of properties other than that particular property, you know, so we kept our clean identities, and, you know, life goes on.
When we used to train people back in the old days, we would, once they were trained, we would then first place send them was the Barbary Coast. because they would bar you within 10 minutes. I mean, all of the bosses knew how to count cards, and so they would count you down immediately. And we would tell the player, like, oh, this is a great place to play. Just go in there and spread, you know. And they would come out 5 or 10 minutes later with that pale look on their face. But as you said, once you get the first one under your belt, you realize, okay, this doesn't really mean anything. And just, you know.
And you learn a lot from your first 86ing. I mean, you kind of learn that, you know, we have fun when we play and we see a lot of smiling faces around. And one thing you kind of notice over time when they're starting to get concerned about you is that those, you know, they stop laughing at your jokes. They stop, they start hovering over the table with a very serious look. They're very bad. They have very bad poker faces.
They also try not to look at you. Like, they'll stand at the podium and try not looking at you. And you can kind of tell that they're, you know, trying to turn their back to you, especially when they get on the phone.
Yeah, we had an incident somewhere where we were up a substantial amount of money, Mr. B was lifetime. And I saw them call the casino manager over to the podium, and I could see the podium in the computer screen from where I was sitting. And they looked up as an account, and it looked like an Excel spreadsheet, and it would have the losing sessions in red and the winning sessions in green. And when they pulled up his spreadsheet, it was an entire sheet of green.
And it was flashing like an old 8-bit computer game, too. It was just like flashing in neon green, and he's sitting there looking at it, and the casino manager's eyes popped out of his head. I like literally never had a losing table session at this place, you know, so they weren't real happy about me.
And I think we were up $20,000 or something on the game.
So you gave him the signal, let's hit the road?
Yes. So, I mean, I definitely gave him the let's get out of here signal. And, you know, we escaped. And as far as I know, we're still good to play there. Although there are some places that Mr. B is generally followed by the counter catcher. But we like to play games with him, too. You know, so Mr. B will check in at Pygow, and he'll check in at you know, craps and so forth, and we just watch this guy follow him all over the casino, because they haven't made his play, they haven't figured out the play, but they know that he's up a substantial amount of money and that he doesn't lose, so we have fun with him. But ultimately, there's some places that Mr. B, we've kind of retired Mr. B from betting the money.
Yeah, now we have Mr. C and Mr. D, and we send those guys out, and they do pretty good.
Yeah. Right. No, I mean, that is the thing. Nowadays, they don't know what you're doing, but you get barred for just winning. And it doesn't matter what the game is.
Right. And we, you know, a lot of our skill set comes from, like, networking and bringing, you know, honest and qualified people, you know, kind of on the team. And, you know, we have a pretty large network of people that don't look like us that we can insert. Like, we have black BPs, I've used Asian BPs, and you know, the things that some of the minorities can get away with is mind-boggling compared to something that a white guy can get away with.
It's funny you say that, because we just recorded a show the other day with a Korean woman. Okay. And the first thing she asked about was, I said that, you know, being an Asian female is worth at least an extra $1 million in the length of your career. And she didn't understand why. Now, of course, she started as a card counter in Las Vegas, which is about the worst thing you can do in the worst place you can do it.
Of course.
So she's had a lot of backoffs. But, yeah, I mean, if I were still active, I would scoop her up as a BP immediately because...
Yeah, it really is amazing that in a spot where a 40-year-old white guy can win maybe, you know, 10,000, a black guy can maybe win 100,000 in that same spot with less heat.
Yes. Yes.
So are you so even though you're burned as a BP, can you go in and bet $5 a hand and give the signals? Is that still
this may have happened at the places we're speaking about.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the natural progression, I think, is in our business plan, at least, is to kind of convert Mr. B into more of a reader and a scout, because, you know, we know all the plays at this point.
You never know.
Yeah.
All
well,
the
we
plays.
Know the plays that we're looking for, but yes, you are correct.
Well, these days, I'm actually more of a talent scout. You know, I think what we're doing right now is just kind of creating a team where we can scale just a little bit, you know, because we have a lot of data and a lot of places we like to play and a lot of plays we like to do. And it's just teaching them to kind of our mentees and getting them out there and kind of just working together with some new people.
One of the issues with that, though, is sometimes you train somebody and they decide they don't need you anymore, and now they've taken everything you've taught them and they go out on their own and become your competition. Have you run into that yet?
Not yet. I mean, we've created opportunities, but that's kind of the end goal, though. I mean, we're not too selfish or greedy. You know, we want to build them to that level, you know, and then just work together with them in the future. You know, it's not big enough to where it's going to, you know, take all the meat off the bone, you know.
Right. We're big on, you know, obviously we want to make money, but we're probably more focused on mentoring young talent. Because we see a lot of young talent, a lot of guys that are a little bit maybe even hungrier than us out there, you know, playing every day. You know, we have families at home, so it's tough to really be on the road all the time. So we try to do, you know, a trip or two a month, and then you know, the rest of our time is kind of spent mentoring in the last couple of years some younger talent who can, you know, that wants to be out there on the road and wants to just has a lot more
fire. I get it. I mean, younger talent is great for the scouting and the reading and things like that. The BPs, you're better off with older people.
I agree. And I sometimes wonder how these 20 somethings ever get a green chip down on some of these plays, looking at them, because they look like, you know, they just came from the math team.
And they're wearing an MIT sweatshirt.
Yes.
Now, given the last few minutes what you said, we're going to be getting lots of queries like, these guys are looking for DPs.
You know, could you tell them that
I'm willing to go on an interview?
Yeah. No, they can send me an email. It's bobdancer@gmail.com.
Well, good. If that's the route you want to go, we can definitely, you know, gambling with an edge@gmail.com, and we'll forward them. But are you looking for new people out of the blue? Just might be a casino employee, you never know. But are you looking for people to build your team?
Anybody that currently works in surveillance or as a slot technician can feel free to apply. I mean, we might have something available for them.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. That's interesting. All right.
I would just say to the listeners, it would be almost impossible for a stranger to do this kind of thing. I mean, sure. I periodically get these kind of questions, and you know, you have to know somebody a long time before you're willing to trust them with your money. And
agreed. I mean, most of the relationships we have are with people either been vouched for many levels or that we've known personally for at least a decade.
Yeah. Tommy Hyland mentioned that he never hired just card counters for his teams. He would get guys he golfed with, you know, that he had known for years and would golf with. And he would rather train someone that he already knows than hire someone he doesn't.
Right. Yeah, and ultimately, I think that it's important to have somebody who's comfortable betting the money and comfortable in the casino betting the money. So that's a very unique kind of personality.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, for big players, really all you need is someone who will not think. They'll just follow directions, right?
Yeah.
Do whatever the signal is.
Yep.
But the one thing they have to be comfortable betting the money. And I had one friend who could not bet the money. His hands would shake if he bet $500. It just, you know, just wasn't a fit for him.
Our training in poker over the years is our ability to not associate and not correlate dollars to like work. I earned this much in my job, so how could I possibly bet 10 times that, you know, what I earn in a week?
On a hand of blackjack. We have a lifetime of desensitization to money, for sure. That's a very good, helpful skill.
Now,
it's just chips.
Yep.
Before the show, you mentioned you had some good stories about the swamp. Now, I don't really know where this is going, but it sounds
like Louisiana to me.
It sounds interesting.
Are there gators involved?
Is this the purse story?
It is the purse story.
I'll let you take it.
No, you can. I'm not telling the purse story.
No, I'll start it, but you take over because you were there. So Mr. B has kind of a metrosexual thing going. He has what's known as, what most people refer to as a European handbag, it's a purse. So, you know, when we're playing in Appalachia or the swamp, you know, when Mr. B rolls in, you know, with his purse, he has some interesting altercations, whether it be going through the airport or at the door. But just imagine, you know, being in the swamp with this 75-year-old woman who's been a security guard there for 40 years. And, you know, the southern lady, and she says, "What's that?" He's like, "Oh, it's
my purse.
It's my purse." Eddie will say, "Yeah, it's my purse." And she'll be like, "Men can't have purses."
So, Mr. B, does your purse match your high heels or not?
My purse typically does match my heels, but it's also typically carrying a bankroll that's usually necessary for these games.
And, yes.
You know, when they don't let you bring it in, you have to get some real full pockets and different things.
They literally, once you show them the bags full of money,
She shook her head and said, "You can't bring that in here," because there was like an iPad purses. In it or something. It was a funny occurrence. And we didn't know each other, so he was already in there. And he's like, "Where were you?" You know, I'm like, long story.
Yeah. Now, what about carrying cash? Have you had problems carrying cash on airplanes or any of that kind of?
Also with the purse. We were going through the airport, I believe it was in North Carolina, a small regional airport, and the 20-year-old policeman was there. It wasn't TSA. There
that'd
was like
be Asheville.
Yeah, that would be Asheville. And they stopped me and they said, "Huh, what you doing here?" So I looked him in the eye, I was direct, and I let him know I wasn't breaking any, you know, local ordinances or anything. And he looked me over and goes, "Well, since you're not nervous, it's probably okay, but I gotta call the chief." And I'm thinking, you know, I hope he's talking about police chief. And, you know, because I mean, we were playing in some Indian casinos, and I got a bit nervous with that, but then they let me go. But I had no idea what was about to happen. So actually, we flew out of that airport 3 times, and I got stopped all 3 times for the same issue.
For the same purse.
For the same purse, yeah.
It's not normal for a man to be walking to be scanning a purse.
It is in Europe.
Yeah,
yeah. As Joe likes to tease me, I'll let him tell you guys about my spare tire story while we were playing on a game one time.
Okay.
Spare tire? Well, you look pretty trim to me.
That's also a lie. So we were on a trip, and we were both driving in, and I got there first and did some scouting and found a game, a very good game, and Mr. B was about, I don't know, 45 minutes behind. So I get my seat on the game, and I'm playing 10-15 minutes, and I get a text and it said "Just blew a tire, will be late." But he had a good relationship with his casino host, and he's like, "I'm gonna make the casino host pay for the tire." Okay, whatever. So hour and a half, 2 hours go by, I'm sitting there betting $10 on one of the most amazing games I think we've ever had. And so Mr. B finally...
Are you firing off the signals into the ether so that it doesn't look different when he gets there?
No. But so Mr. B finally
that
rolls in.
That might be a good idea to try next time.
So Mr. B finally rolls in, sweat pouring out. He ran from the car. He got a spare tire or whatever. So he sits down, and we just put out 2 hands of near table Max. And, you know, 5 minutes goes by, and his casino host walks over, and, you know, Mr. B wants to tell him about, you know, compensating for his tire. And so he's talking to, he has his back turned to me, he's talking to the casino host, and there's a situation where we need to take insurance. And so I give him the signal for the insurance, and he has his back turned to me because he's talking to the casino host. And I'm slamming on the table. "You don't have it. You don't have it. You don't have it." I'm slamming, and he's just completely oblivious. Right? And finally, I just decided, you know what? The hell with it. Let him take the money. So the dealer opens up blackjack and takes his money. And about this time, he turns around, and his money is gone. And he has this look on his face of, like, what just happened here? And he looks over at me, and I'm doing the signal, take insurance. And he just starts laughing, and then I start laughing, and then the dealer says, "Oh, do you guys know each other?"
Yeah, that was a very expensive tire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got the tire for free. It only cost you $2,000.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Luckily, in those kind of spots, you know, because we're good friends, you know, we just kind of look at those kind of things as, funny and a learning opportunity.
You know,
we can.
If it were me, I would have said to the dealer, "Hey, he's betting a lot of money. You better see if he wants insurance."
Yeah, and so that's the kind of twisted relationship we have. Is like, you know, poker players are weird. You know, we used to bet all on the streets of online poker, and you know, like a good day for you is ruining one of your best friend's day. You know, so that's kind of an extension of like how we live now. But you know, we don't really look at, you know, the micro very often. You know, we kind of look at the big picture, and the game was plenty good to the point where we were going to probably quit early anyway before the game was over. So I didn't really sweat it too much.
So when you have a BP relationship, it usually you would have some kind of profit sharing thing, but now it sounds like you each have your own bankrolls and you keep it separate, which sounds unusual.
No, I in that last story, I lit half of my money on fire too, and that was just kind of the fun of how we do, you know, just kind of how we do things. You know, we have trip bankrolls. You know, we're 50-50 partners. All results get chopped up and
at the end of the weekend.
At the end
or
of the
whatever.
Week, yeah, that's, yeah.
Well, I eventually moved to that kind of scheme, and by far has been my favorite because we had all kinds of complicated bankroll sharing things with long-term targets and different, but yeah, if there are three of us or four of us, we just, at the end of the trip, we just chop it evenly, win or lose, and to me, that's the best way to go.
No matter who put in the most hours or had the biggest bankroll coming in or anything like that?
Well, on the things that I'm doing, usually everybody is playing together, because it usually requires however many there are, but even if not, even if people, like, let's say we're rotating in and out or whatever. No, it doesn't matter how many hours or whatever. It's just the trip is the trip, and we're all right in for the trip.
And we keep our, you know, our team attitude kind of laid back, and you know, we're perfectly fine if, you know, on this trip these two guys do more work than this other guy that we have with us.
Exactly.
It's just part of the deal.
Yep.
We
split the expenses, so. Yeah. You know, the hotels are paid for, but we cover our own airfares or whatever. I mean, but we just
don't sweat the small stuff.
Yeah, we just don't sweat it.
Yeah.
Although I have to say, it is really rather odd that the guys I play with are all, I guess you would say, wealthy, but we'll end up all four of us staying in the same hotel room. mainly because we're talking kind of late into the wee hours and would rather be staying in the same room together than having our own.
And share adjustments that you're going to make with the signals and stuff like that.
Yeah, right. I mean, to me, that's some of my favorite parts of this is sitting there and saying, what if we tried this? Or what if we did that? And kind of coming up with new things, you know?
Right, and we're good at that. You know, we always give constructive criticism, and we're partners on a lot of kind of different adventures right now, and we always just throw a lot of ideas back and forth, not only just gambling related, but you know, business as well,
investing and family and everything. You know,
do you help pick out his purses?
His wife does that.
Yeah, I would say he's had a positive influence on my personal style.
He's not showing that today, folks.
No,
for anyone
no.
Not listening on color radio.
Yeah.
right now he's dressed as sharply as Richard and I are. It's very good. It's been fun having you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This was good. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.